Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Monday morning, house call time with Dr. Kevin Most, Chief Medical Officer at Northwestern Medicine Central DuPage Hospital. Doctor, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Bob. How about yourself?
I'm getting up there to about 60%, and yeah. I'm loaded with questions about the coronavirus. Let's start with the one on everybody's mind, I think. Kids going back to school. Good idea. What do we need to be concerned with here?
Yeah, this is obviously one that everyone across the country is struggling with, and you're seeing the extremes from we're not going back to school at all to we're going back full bore. And I think you can argue both sides. You know, when I look at the younger kids, the impact on these kids from an educational point of view is one thing, but also nutritional. You know, a lot of these kids need those meals because that's their best meal of the day. One in five kids has some type of learning disability and really won't learn well in a home setting on a computer. They need that professional teacher to actually guide them along. The other side is going to say, hey, you put all these kids together, how are you going to keep masks on them? And if you don't, are they going to get infected and bring it home to their parents and grandparents? But boy, I'll tell you, it is going to be a tough decision. Schools were not built for physical distancing that we would expect. So if you go into a hybrid model now where half the kids are there and half are at home, where are you going to get the additional teachers who are going to be doing the home teaching, or is that all going to be self-learned? And if so, we also have the impact of a lot of families have double-income parents in order to make ends meet. So, boy, it's a tough discussion and decision. And like I said, I could go either way.
Here in Illinois, what concerns a lot of people, the 7-day positivity rate now is 3%, still low, but moving up. How are we doing in Illinois? Because obviously that is going to affect a lot of these decisions about kids back in school.
Yeah, the timing of this is going to be really critical, because if we look at what's happening in Illinois now, it's the same things that were happening in Arizona and Florida, three, four weeks ago. So jump ahead 4 weeks, we'll be right around the start of school. Are we going to start to see this big uptick? And that is probably the concern. We here at CDH have been laying pretty flat. We had a little bit of uptake this weekend. I'm not sure if that's going to trend out through the week. But we're also starting to see now one trend that we've seen across the country, and that's that age group of, 20 to 30 to young 30s. That's where we're seeing positivity rates that are double what we're seeing, in Illinois. If we took that cohort of group out of the study, the Illinois positivity rate would be, 2.5%. Instead, we're 3% because of the 6% of those that we're seeing that are coming from that demographic of that 20 to 30 age group.
So the millennials, they now have the highest daily case rate of the virus. Is that right?
Yep. Yep, they do. And that's kind of expected if you start to think about it. This is a group of very socially active individuals. They have been pent up and locked up, essentially, with nearly no access for their social activities until just recently. Now you put them in this social activity, they feel invincible, and it's not surprising that we're seeing the increased number there and the spread in this demographic.
Are you and your colleagues marking your calendar for next weekend? Because that'll be 2 weeks since the July 4th holiday, and I'm fearing a spike there. Are you?
Yeah, actually, we're even looking at it now. Over the weekend, the past week, we've been doing 1, 2, 3 admissions a day and just kind of hanging steady. We had 7 admissions yesterday. So, is this going to come a little bit earlier? Because it's interesting when you look at the lag, and we talk about the lag. The lag for a lot of this, especially with 4th of July, is different, we think, because it's often in a big family setting, right? So it wasn't, we opened the bars, the kids went to bars, then they eventually got exposed to their grandparents, and then the effects hit. In this situation, grandparents were often with them in that initial social setting, so that extra step of 3 to 4 days of communication had already occurred because they were in the same setting at the same time.
Mm-hmm. When you and other medical experts say kids are not as likely to get the virus, what ages are we actually talking about? Do we know?
We really don't. And the interesting thing about that is we say that, and we haven't put a lot of science or data behind it. And what I'm saying there is, if you look at where we've been testing and who we've been testing, we haven't really focused on that pediatric population much because they're asymptomatic. They really don't show any signs. There's not a whole heck of a lot going on. If we really were to push our testing to all the way down to that pediatrics, many are concerned, is there a lot of asymptomatic cases that we aren't even testing for? You know, here, the only pediatric patients we're testing for right now are those who have had an exposure, have symptoms, or are coming into the hospital. We're not seeing them go to the drive-through areas. As a matter of fact, a lot of the drive-through areas aren't taking any pediatric patients. So we really don't know the impact of kids, and yet it's being touted across the country as, boy, kids are pretty resilient to this.
Also, how likely are kids to spread it to adults? Any numbers on that? Any studies on that?
Yeah, you know, so when they're doing, if we could do more contact tracing, that would be great. But the initial contact tracing that we've been able to do, it doesn't appear that it's seeing, we're seeing a lot of peds to adults. We're seeing a lot of adults to peds, but we're not seeing a lot of the other way. So the pediatric patients don't seem to be spreading it. Is that good? Yeah, it could be, especially if we're considering opening schools. Do we know enough, and is that data accurate enough? I'm not so sure yet.
Continuing our Monday morning house call from Dr. Kevin Most. Doc, are there more asymptomatic people out there than you first thought?
Oh, yeah. Yep, I think now, you know, when we first started this and we started doing testing, we really didn't have the infrastructure in place to do the contact tracing. Now, at least in many parts of the country, it's, I wouldn't say totally advanced, but it has certainly advanced a lot more than it was. And what contact tracing is two things happen there. One is we find out someone's positive, and then we say, okay, tell us who you've been exposed to for the past X number of days. And two things happen there. One, it's possible that we find who that person exposed themselves to and potentially have infected, so we want to make sure that they are now aware that they've had an exposure. And two, what we really also want to do is, where did you catch this? Which person did this, you know, give this virus to you? So those are the two things about contact tracing that we're doing. So now we're starting to find out the asymptomatic patients, how many of them are out there, because they were actually essentially patient zero for many of these individuals who had infections. If you look at the estimates, they're saying, you know, 10 times the number of people that actually tested positive are out there. So the number is pretty substantial.
Are asymptomatic people more contagious than first thought?
Well, yeah. And that's a interesting way to look at a question, right? If you're asymptomatic, how do I know when you first got it? So if I don't know when you first got it, I don't know how many people you've spread it to. And if I don't know how many you've spread it to, I can't tell you how contagious you are. So we do know that they are contagious. We do know that they can spread the illness. We just can't get back to that ground zero point of saying, you know, for someone who has symptoms, we know those first 2 to 5 days are going to be the most important. They're spewing more virus than at any other time during the infection. That's the most important time to keep them enclosed and keep them isolated. For the asymptomatics, we can't get back to what's day one, what's day two, mm-hmm. because we don't know where it started.
Are you seeing more patients who have problems months after the infection with COVID-19, folks who can't shake the illness?
Yeah, so that's obviously probably one of the bigger concerns, especially those individuals who had extended time on a ventilator or were in the intensive care unit a great period of time. you know, two, anybody lays around in a hospital bed for a few days, you're going to decondition some of your muscles. So that's one portion of it. But probably the most important thing is this illness affects more than just our lungs, although it does do major damage to our lungs in some patients. But we know it also does damage to our hearts. So as we're looking now, we're still in the infancy of many of these patients have only been, you know, post-infection for a month or two. But yeah, we are seeing, you know, a lot of patients needing to go to rehab. And then the long-term effects of this on their lungs is going to be pretty substantial because it's not like a typical pneumonia where the bacteria get in, we kill the bacteria, and the lungs come back. This virus goes in and decides it's going to wreak havoc, and it really damages the lungs and actually breaks down the lungs. So we know that individuals that really had it bad in their lungs in the intensive care on ventilators for a long period of time, they're going to have some respiratory problems potentially for the rest of their lives.
The question about blood type keeps coming up. There have been reports that type O blood appears to be protective against the virus when compared to other blood types. Do we know anything definite on this yet?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We started looking at blood types, you know, and it was more, I don't want to say it was kind of found serendipitously, but it kind of was. It's because if you really think about it, well, why would blood type have anything to do with this? But as we start to collect data and a lot of data on a lot of patients, they were able to see that those individuals with type O blood actually were protected. So they had, you know, up to like a 20% protective rate, which is pretty darn good. So if your chances were, you know, very high to get it and you decreased it to 20%, that's really excellent. Still trying to figure out exactly why. Does it have to do with the antibodies of the blood type? Does it have to do with any other genetic material that we know are in type O patients? So still in its infancy as to why, but we do know, and it has been shown, that individuals with type O blood are going to have some protection.
And I wanted to ask you finally about this story I read in the New Yorker, headline, How Iceland Beat the Coronavirus. And it seems like it wasn't masks. A lot of people weren't wearing masks there. It was that the health officials just ruled the country. No politics at all there. And granted, it's an isolated place, and I think the population of the whole country about the same as the city of Denver. Was it contact tracing? Was that the other thing? Because they pretty much beat the coronavirus completely, didn't they?
Yeah, they whooped it. And I mean, if you looked at that, they kudos to their entire team there. I mean, they even used law enforcement to help in portions of theirs. But you're absolutely right. What they did is they saw these cases come out of China, and they took it extremely seriously.
And they did it early, right?
Correct. They were planned well before they even had their first case. And then once they did aggressive contact tracing, close follow-up with all of those phone calls almost every day. They contained that isolation. They had high-level testing. They minimized travel. They actually went down to the genetic level to find out how this spread. Iceland is a very popular tourist destination. Well, they found that mutations were coming from, you know, Italy and from the United States. Well, they shut down travel to those places, you know, and it was amazing. I think books will be written about how they handled this crisis and how it could be a boilerplate for some places. Like you said, they're isolated. They're an island with a small population that they have a ton of genetic information and a ton of information on each of these individuals' health. So in a closed environment, they did a really great job. And yeah, like you said, they don't wear masks in Iceland unless you're really sick.
Right. Dr. Kevin Most, always appreciate the good information. I'm so glad that you passed all your med school exams, Dr. Most.
we so like am I, Bob.
Have a good week. We'll talk to you next Monday morning.
Take care. Thank you.